What's up, guys? It's Albert. Got a great show for you today. Fantastic guests coming in to talk about Lamar Jackson. You get all my Week 12 takeaways, and as always, we'll wrap things up with your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer. Week 12 is in the books, and we have so much to get to. Got a great guest coming up to talk about what else? Lamar Jackson, the Baltimore Ravens, where they go from here. And we're going to get to all your questions in the mailbag. We're starting, as we always do, with the takeaways. And my number one takeaway, again, this is easy, is Lamar Jackson. And I'm going to raise my hand here. I'm going to change my opinion. I'm going to change my leader in the clubhouse for the most valuable player. Maybe it's not real fair to Russell Wilson after they went into Philadelphia and beat a good Eagles team. But what Lamar Jackson is doing is off the charts. And I look at it now, and I think we can all see this. It's the perfect marriage of a special athlete who has dedicated himself to improving. His improvement in his accuracy has been staggering. Like, you normally don't get a lot better in that area. He's gotten a lot better in that area. So it's a special athlete who's dedicated himself to improving and has coaches who are sold out to highlight the very best in him, in John Harbaugh and Greg Roman. And what we're seeing right now, and you look at his numbers from last night, and they're great. You know, like, they're very, very good. They're efficient as hell. 15 of 20 for 169 yards and 5 touchdowns. 95 yards on 8 attempts. That's 264 all-purpose yards. So that's great, right? Like, that's a great amount of – that's a very efficient performance. But I don't think those 264 yards properly illustrate what he's doing to defenses on a week-to-week basis, how hard he's making it on everybody on a week-to-week basis, and how when other teams play the Ravens, they look like – I mean, like, it literally looks like they haven't been preparing. And it's not even fair to them to say it that way, because there isn't – and Sean McVay said it after the game – there isn't a way to prepare for this. There isn't a way to train your eyes to see things as fast as they move in the Ravens offense without actually going up against it at game speed. And there's – you know, it's hard to simulate having to get out there and bring Lamar Jackson to the ground, because there are very, very few people on the planet that can move the way that he can. And so – I can't wait to see where this goes from here, because this isn't just a great athlete making plays with his feet. This is now a guy playing quarterback, and a guy who's learned to play quarterback, and a guy who's gotten more accurate, and a guy who, you know, I think to some degree, and I hate to, like, I don't want to overreact here, because I know we've said this about guys in the past, like Cam Newton, like Robert Griffin when he got hot as a rookie. Maybe this is one of those that he's so special where he causes people to change the way that they evaluate and look at the position a little bit. He's been fantastic, no question about it. And the defense is getting better, which is sort of the hidden thing here. You look at what they were able to do, the Rams offense. At one point, the yardage, I think, was like 460 to 107, which is bananas. I mean, that's the sort of thing you see in, like, you know, when Alabama's playing the Citadel. You don't see it in an NFL game. And that's a Rams team that, for all their issues, came in at 6-4. It's remarkable what the Ravens are doing, and the way that they're mowing teams down, and good teams, you know, the way that they were able to go into Seattle and win, the way that they were able to beat New England on the Sunday night stage, and now again going cross country, prime time, and taking out another team that was in the Super Bowl in the Rams. Just 10 months ago, you can't say enough. And I think the big thing here is you're seeing other pieces of the team getting better too. You know, and so that's, you know, Lamar Jackson's been there all year. I think Mark Ingram and that run game have gotten better. I think the receiver group has gotten more comfortable, and they've got young guys playing like Miles Boykin and Mark Andrews and Hollywood Brown. They've got a lot of young guys that they're leaning on. It's a confident group. That's going to be very, very hard to deal with for anybody going forward. So the flip side of that, and this will be my second takeaway, what has happened to the Los Angeles Rams, and where are the Los Angeles Rams? And I know that there are a lot of people out there that want to use this as an opportunity to dump on Sean McVay, and everybody's caught up to him and everything else. I don't believe that. I think there are a couple things at work here that I think do explain it. First of all, over the first 2 years that Sean McVay was there, they were one of the best offensive lines in football. with Andrew Whitworth, with John Sullivan, with Roger Saffold, with Havenstein. It was a really good group. So you take Saffold out, you take Sullivan out, you put young guys in, the young guys get hurt. Now you're moving pieces around. Austin Corbett, who washed out of a bad offensive line in Cleveland, he's starting and playing the whole game against the Ravens. Start there. That's number one. Everything is that much harder if you're not doing a good job up front. And the Rams did a really nice job of putting together a group that took care of things up front the last 2 years. And they lost a couple of those guys this offseason. And so that's a factor. The second factor, they're not running the ball the same way. And Todd Gurley's not the same guy. And on Monday night, and part of this is that the game got away from him, so you couldn't run the ball as much, 22 yards on the ground. Okay? So why isn't Jared Goff playing as well? Well, his first 2 years in the league, one of the things that Sean McVay did to make him more comfortable was everything was off of play action, right? Put him in a position to play faster. Put him in a position to think less. Put him in a position where the world wasn't on his shoulders. Well, now the offensive line isn't there. The running backs haven't been as good. And so what happens? Naturally, more is going to be on Jared Goff to carry the team. And most quarterbacks struggle in those circumstances. And Jared Goff has struggled in those circumstances. So to use this to say, like, well, everybody's caught up with Sean McVay, I think you're sort of missing the mark here. This is still about the players that are out there on the field, and they don't have the same sort of infrastructure in place to run the offense the way that Sean McVay ran the offense in 2017 and 2018. That's made them more reliant on the defense, and when the defense doesn't play well, you have nights like you had Monday night. Number three. The Dallas Cowboys sure look like they are closing in on their first coaching change in 9 years. Jason Garrett's in a contract year. Jerry Jones has not been shy over the course of the last 3 or 4 days about criticizing the job that Jason Garrett and his staff have done. And remember, because Jason Garrett's in a contract year, you're naturally at a crossroads. You don't even have to fire him. You're not eating a dollar by letting him go. So you can do that, but if you're going to keep him, you got to drop a whole new contract. You got to commit to him for a bunch more years. You got to commit a bunch more money to him. So what do the Cowboys want to do here? And a couple things kind of stuck out to me in that game that I think was what – a couple things on the field and one thing off the field I think sort of stuck out to me about the timing of all of this. Off the field, when you heard the rumors, and you know, Ian Rappaport, my buddy at NFL Network, reported on Jason Garrett and the Giants potentially having their eye on Jason Garrett. Here's what I can tell you. The Mara family loves Jason Garrett. Jason Garrett was there as a player. Jason Garrett has roots in the area. He went to school at Princeton. Jason Garrett might be a better fit organizationally for the Giants than he is for the Cowboys. So I don't know that it's unrelated that Jerry's all of a sudden pretty upset about this when maybe he perceives that there could be some sort of back channeling there going on, or that maybe there's some work being done in that regard where, you know, maybe Giants are seeing if Jason Garrett would be available if they moved on from Pat Shurmur. Maybe Jason Garrett is preparing himself for the eventuality he might be gone. So if I could see where Jerry, if Jerry were to perceive that, where he might be upset about that. The other thing is the stuff that happened in that game in Foxborough on that stage. And Jerry's very cognizant of the Patriots as a measuring stick. Jerry's very cognizant of being in that 4 o'clock Fox window. I know that sounds silly, but it's important to him. And some of the things that, it's not just getting beat. It's getting a punt blocked. It's the spot later in the game, and that punt block led to points. It's a spot later in the game where you had the delay of game penalty, and then you had the illegal motion penalty, which pushed the punt team back. And then you saw the bad punt, a short punt, create a short field for the Patriots, and the Patriots wind up scoring points off of that. So you see these unforced errors, these sort of hallmarks of a team that maybe isn't great or isn't all that well coached, popping up. And so I think those two things conspire. And Jerry comes out of that and he's hot. He thinks he's got a team that's right in a window to compete for a championship, to win a championship. He's got a bunch of guys he's already paid, guys like Zeke Elliott and Jalen Smith. He's got a bunch of guys he's going to have to pay, guys like Amari Cooper and Dak Prescott. He's right in that window to win a championship. And so there's all this stuff going on, and it rubs him the wrong way. And so it's been interesting to see the way he reacts, and they're on a short week. They play Buffalo on Thanksgiving Day. Okay, number four. I already said that Lamar's my MVP. Russell Wilson would be number two now. Do we consider somebody in another position? Because we talked about Christian McCaffrey some, but I think that's faded a little bit because they're not as good. They haven't played as well of late. We've talked about Dalvin Cook a little bit, and Dalvin Cook's definitely an interesting one, but the Vikings have always been known as sort of a defensively driven team. And so Cook's been almost as good, if not as good, as McCaffrey. Deserves to be in the Offensive Player of the Year conversation, but I don't know that you put him in the MVP conversation. What about Michael Thomas from the Saints? I had a conversation with him about this on Sunday night. I think he's a fascinating case. And here's the play that illustrates that. Third and six. They're about their own 35. Game tied. Everything's on the line. 39 seconds left, I think. Everybody in the building knows the ball's going to Mike Thomas. The Saints know it. The Panthers know it. The guy in section 315 knows it. And Mike Thomas still gets open, still registers the catch, moves the chains. Saints wind up kicking a field goal to win the game. If we're ever going to consider a receiver for that award, I think this is the sort of receiver it's got to be. The guy who gets the ball, even when everybody knows that's where it's going. To me, this is a little bit like Larry Fitzgerald in 2009, where everyone knew in the big spots that year, everyone knew the ball was going to Fitz, and there was nothing the defense could do about it. And it feels that way with Thomas. And so with Drew Brees coming back off the injury, with the defense not playing as well on Sunday, Mike Thomas was the guy they leaned on. And so it's going to be interesting to see where the Saints go from here. I think it's going to be important that they play indoors, and so home field is going to be an important piece of this, the battle for home field, which is going to be between them and the Niners and the Seahawks now. Having a potential NFC championship game, the Vikings would be in that mix too, the Packers. Having a potential NFC championship game in the Superdome rather than outside in San Francisco or Seattle or Green Bay, obviously Minnesota's inside too, I think would be big for the Saints. And having a player like Mike Thomas, I think, in the biggest spots. Again, like the receiver that I think of when I watch the way he's playing right now is Larry Fitzgerald in 2000. And it was not 2009, it was 2008. Okay, finally, last thing before we get to our guest. Something needs to be done about the officiating. And the phantom tripping calls against the Cowboys in the Patriots game were one thing. We saw what happened with the Saints against the Panthers. That's another thing. The pass interference mess in general this year has been a disaster. I think that the league needs to do something. And I took Sean Payton's comments of saying he wants a board of five people or whatever making a decision. I saw that as a direct shot at the officiating department, and I saw that as a direct shot at Al Riveron. Might be wrong that maybe that wasn't Sean's intention. I just know enough coaches that don't trust Al Riveron right now, don't trust the officiating department, and it's to the point where they feel like the offensive pass interference and defensive pass interference reviews, the way those have been handled, is the officials fighting back against what the coaches did in March. It's a definition of a toxic relationship. And so much of the job of the guy that's in that role, in Al Riveron's role, is to build relationships with the coaches, is to be a liaison between the officials and the coaches and the football teams. And if that guy isn't doing that effectively enough, then you need to make a change to that spot. So I like Al Riveron personally. I'm sure he was a great on-field official. But if you're not managing the relationship between the coaches and the officials properly, then a change needs to be made. And that was the job when Dean Blandino was in it. That was the job when Mike Pereira was in it. That's the job. Is so much of that job isn't just sitting in there in the command center on Sunday. It's managing the relationships between the coaches and the league. It's being able to find solutions when it may seem like there aren't any. So something needs to be done about that. And I think when you've got a relationship like exists right now between Riveron and the coaches, it's probably time for the league to make a change at that level. All right. Got a great guest coming up. We'll get to him right after this. And now we're going to welcome in a good friend of mine, former Notre Dame head coach, former Kansas head coach, ex-offensive coordinator of the New England Patriots during three of their championship years, and the Kansas City Chiefs. Welcome in Charlie Weiss. Charlie, what's happening?
Hey, Bert, how are you doing, my man?
We're doing great. Okay, so I brought you in to talk about Lamar Jackson, and I'm sure you watched on Monday night what he did to the Los Angeles Rams, a defense that's actually played really well. I'm just wondering, from a football coach's standpoint, when you're watching what happened there, what's popping into your head as he and that running game are ripping Wade Phillips' defense apart?
Well, this has been going on now for over a month, where they've been playing against teams that have been, pretty good football teams and just whooping up on them. And I think that what Baltimore has done is they've taken rare talents that are different than most other quarterbacks in this league and built an offense to around him. And it's a fairly unique approach where they've said, okay, we got this guy. He has things that he's special at. Let's do a lot of that. And, good luck trying to stop that. They're not running very many plays. They're running inside zone, outside zone, and then read option. I mean, it's really about three runs that they're running. And then if you try to sell out on them, which people try to do, if you try to sell out on them, then throw the ball to wide open tight ends or wide receivers. So good luck trying to defend this right now.
What's so hard about dealing with it? If it's that simple, right? Like, what's so hard about dealing with it from a football coach's standpoint?
Well, it's like playing against one of the academies in college that all of a sudden you're going against, the option. And you don't see the option anymore. It's not like you got the olden days when you had, Oklahoma playing the wishbone. And you play like Navy. You play schools like that where you got 1 week to get ready for them. And even if you spent some time, a month earlier during a bye week, even if you spend some time getting ready on a game week to play this, even to simulate the offense in practice is difficult because it's so many tight ends and running backs / fullbacks that you have to deal with. It's different than most other things that you're seeing on a regular basis.
Well, in Notre Dame, you played against the academies, right? Like every year, pretty much. What do you remember about preparing for? I mean, I'm assuming you had to get creative with who you were putting at quarterback on the scout team and that sort of stuff.
You did. It was different, though. It was, and the thing was, now all of a sudden you'll see defenses like with no safety in the middle of the field because they're trying to get them involved in run force. Well, you leave yourself very vulnerable in the passing game, and you see that Lamar doesn't throw that many passes, but in a game because he doesn't have to. But when he does, it's usually a completion, sometimes to just wide open guys. And other times, he's done a pretty good job of sticking it in there when he has to. They're really putting defenses in a bind on what to do, what to do first. And obviously everyone's going to say, stop the run game. Well, stop the run game normally is to stop the halfback. And this is no longer about just stopping the halfback because the quarterback is even more dangerous than the halfback when he's got the ball in his hands.
Yeah, I had somebody put it in an interesting way to me a couple weeks ago. Said it's almost like they have their downhill back and their change of pace back in the game at the same time. And that's enormously difficult to deal with.
Yeah, the downhill back is the back in the backfield. You're right. And the change of pace, the outside guy to make you miss guy is the quarterback. And he's taken one too many hits. That concerns me a little bit. But, it's dynamic right now. And, as you look at teams, you say, well, do they have staying power? Could you keep doing this? I think that these guys have the right idea. When you get to an off season, you always should build around who your offense, around what your quarterback can do. And whatever your quarterback can do, that you should start there. And they've done a good job of taking what he could do. Hey, look, it wasn't that long ago they were playing the Chargers in a playoff game and he was completing three passes and everyone was booing him out of the stadium.
Right.
That wasn't that long ago. So and it wasn't like in the offseason anyone of their opponents didn't know that they were going to go to a run play action heavy type of deal featuring his skills. And now we're 12 games into the season. What they're doing is no big surprise. You see a lot of 13 people, which is one back, three tight ends and a wide receiver. You see a lot of 21 people, with two backs and a tight end, or 22 people. Tight ends and running backs are tight ends and fullbacks have become more prevalent in this offense than any offense in football right now. And, it really puts you in a bind.
It's got to be like, especially like with the way that the NFL's gone too, you have a lot of teams that are getting smaller on defense, right? Like, because they're trying to deal with the passing game. And so you got 230-pound linebackers and 250-pound defensive ends and smaller safeties who might be converted corners. Like, I would think that would give the Ravens a distinct, like, just almost a natural advantage, right? Like, because they're kind of antithetical. I'm going to mispronounce. God, I'm butchering that word. Antithetical vocabulary is not at a Notre Dame level, Charlie.
your point is well taken, that a lot of teams have gone to the more athletic lineman, the more athletic linebacker, the more athletic, safety type, to try to not get caught in these unbelievably bad matchups, especially with teams that can expose you with a dynamic back coming out of the backfield. I think at the end of the day, you got to force them into making some mistakes. That was almost a mistake-free game they played last
yeah.
night. I mean, when every time you get the ball, you go down and score a touchdown. I mean, it doesn't make a difference what your defense is doing in a situation like that. And you could say, well, keep them on the bench. Well, that sounds good, but keep them on the bench. But when they've been sitting on the bench for a while, and now they get the ball back and they go on a 15-play drive and go right down the field and score like it's no big deal. So whether it's a 4-play drive or a 15-play drive, it seems like they're not getting slowed down, because third down where it usually is a down you're concerned with. Hey, the guy was 7 for 7 at one point in the game on third down passes.
Right.
So I mean, if you look at it, they're putting themselves in good situations on third down. I mean, even if they get a penalty called on them, they're not afraid to run the ball to get it down into a more manageable situations. They're playing very low risk. There isn't much risk, and they're not exposing themselves to a lot of mistakes.
Does it it looks like Lamar's more accurate too. Like, I don't know if it's my eyes doing tricks on me, but like, he certainly looks more accurate than he was at Louisville. And, I mean, I think he even looks more accurate than he was last year.
Hold on a second. Now.
Yeah.
You're talking about a guy who won the Heisman Trophy his junior year.
No, I know, Charlie, but I'm saying just like as a passer.
I mean, the guy's slinging it all over the yard. And his senior year, he was even better. The only reason he didn't win the Heisman Trophy his senior year is because Baker had a phenomenal year.
Right.
But he did say, and I have paid attention a lot to this guy, he did say that he had trouble last year throwing an NFL football.
Yeah.
NFL footballs are bigger than college footballs. And he said he did have trouble. So he said in the offseason, he spent a lot more time, just throwing an NFL football. And it seems to me that's paid big dividends, because now he's throwing a much tighter spiral. It wasn't like he didn't throw spirals when he was in college. He just had a lot smaller football.
Yeah.
These are key things that most people don't realize, that there are differences. There's a difference in the size of the ball between college and the pros. Now he's playing with that bigger ball. He spent the time in the offseason getting used to throwing this bigger ball. and now it's become much less of a challenge for him.
Okay, so I have this, like, and this is just sort of, I don't know, this is like always kind of been my question with this stuff, and the way we've seen offenses change and everything else. Yeah, I remember when I was like a teenager watching Tommy Frazier dominate college football, right? And I know that there were a ton of quarterbacks, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s who just weren't seen as fits for the NFL. Even like a guy like Scott Frost, who is fantastic as, you know, a quarterback at Nebraska. And I think you were with him in New York, if I'm not mistaken, right?
We took him to the Jets, yeah.
Yep. And like, I'm wondering if, like, you as a football coach, like, do you ever wonder about, like, some of those quarterbacks of the past, of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, who maybe there would have been a home for them in the NFL now where there wasn't back then?
Oh, I don't think that any guy who's ever called plays and been a coordinator hasn't thought about what you would do if, let's say if I was the offensive coordinator for, give me any team. Let's just say the Patriots.
Okay.
Let's say Tommy's gone.
Yeah.
And you're bringing and this is who our quarterback is. Well, then tell me who it is before I tell you what we're doing.
Right.
And that's a mistake that a lot of people make. They want to bring in a quarterback and run what they do, meaning what the coordinator wants to do, rather than do what the quarterback can do. You know, I can remember back to the 90s when I was at calling plays for the Jets, and we had Vinny Testaverde. Vinny wanted less plays, not more plays. Most quarterbacks want more passes. Vinny wanted less because he wanted more reps at the ones he liked the most and didn't want, you know, a bunch of different ideas. Even if they were good ideas, you know, he wanted the ones he was the most comfortable with. Well, is that really that much different than what you're doing right now with Lamar?
Right.
You're taking a handful of runs. You're taking a handful of passes. And not that he's not capable of more, but he's obviously good at those plays. I mean, watch it last night. He was perfect.
Right.
You know, so why do you need to overthink this? You know, you go in each week figuring out what you need to do. And the big question people always have, well, what would they do if they were down 3 scores? And my answer would be, it would depend on how much time was left in the game. Because if they were down 3 scores at halftime, they're not going to stop doing what they do. The only time they would start throwing a ball significantly more is if they didn't know they had enough possessions, you know, possessions to be able to come back in a game. Then and only then would they go to something open, because that's really not what they want to do.
Yeah, you know what's crazy about it too, Charlie, is like I took note of this yesterday or on Monday night. Like they were still running the ball like in their 2-minute offense at the end of the first half. Like I'm looking at it now, 6-yard run, Justice Hill. Then they throw to Mark Andrews. Then Lamar Jackson, 12-yard run. Justice Hill, 11-yard run. Justice Hill, 1-yard run. And then Lamar throws to Seth Roberts for 16 and Willie Snead for the touchdown. They're still running the ball in their 2-minute offense. It's like that's staggering to me. Like that you're that comfortable that you're going to be productive enough to move the ball fast with your running game that you can do that.
Well, the thing about Lamar too, his runs are almost all end up being outside runs. You know, he did have the one scramble up the middle, a couple of scrambles up the middle, but his runs.
Yeah.
His like read option plays are all outside. So, I mean, and they're almost all of them end up being for chunks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very seldom do you see them being for 4 or 5 yards. They're usually for 10, 15, 20 yards. So, it's really exciting to watch. You know, it looks like there's a good potential of a big heavyweight fight coming up towards the end of the season right now. Because it's destined for those two teams at the top to have a rematch and see how it turns out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so here's a global question for you. You know, I remember having a conversation with Chip Kelly about this, and he didn't like the word revolutionary. He said that he thinks everything in football is evolutionary. And he mentioned to me that there was a coach at TCU, I think his name was Dutch Meyer, in the 1940s that was actually running RPOs, right? Like they weren't called that back then, but he was like, his whole point was all this stuff, it's like it's rare to find stuff that's truly new in football. And everybody's stealing from everybody and all of that. How much of what the Ravens are doing in your mind is innovative and new and different, and how much of it is just being willing to go back in history and look and see, okay, like this would work, this would work, this would work for Lamar?
I agree with what Chip said about it being evolutionary rather than revolutionary. I think that everything ends up being copycat of some era. Okay, you say RPOs. We were running RPOs in the 90s. It just wasn't with the same type of pass patterns. There were hitches rather than running more of a tree than they run now. We played one game against the Denver Broncos where we were like 22 out of 25, and I think I called 3 drop-back passes the entire game. All the other plays were runs that we ended up throwing the ball. I mean, so I think that somewhere along the line, look, if you really look at the foundational runs they're running, okay, you look at the foundational runs they're running, I mean, inside zone, outside zone, read option, I mean, you know, a couple of scheme plays, but really most of them are just get a hat on a hat, get a lead blocker on a linebacker, and let's go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's – I mean, like – and I think you said it too. I mean, like so much of – I think like the – like what I've got, like the respect that a lot of football coaches I feel like they have for Greg Roman right now is how he's just sold out to get the most out of his player. You know, like it's just he's all in on his quarterback and we're going to do whatever's best for him, which is exactly what you were talking about earlier.
You know, it's funny. I mean, you know, the irony of this, you know, Coach Bulla died last night, 85 years old. You know what he's known for?
No.
Introducing a 34 defense.
Okay.
First guy to introduce a 34 defense. So you think about it. He's 85 years old, introduces a 34 defense. How many times have you heard about the difference between a 4-man front and a 34 defense?
A lot.
I mean, a zillion?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, ever since, okay, I was 5 years old, probably, right?
So if there was no Coach Bulla, there might not have been a 34 defense.
Right.
You know? So, you know, somebody would have come up with it, you know, down the road, but you know, it's just the way things go. I look at the plays they're running. I have already in my mind have translated how I would call those plays in our terminology.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I'd call them? You got lead, you got stretch, you got inside zone, you got lead op, and you got read option. I mean, and you put numbers to it or whatever, and there you got yourself your plays. I mean, so I'm watching the game and I'm taking his plays and I'm translating in my mind as if I were going to use them. Now, of course, you know, I'm too old to use them, but that doesn't stop my mind from using them.
But Charlie Jr. is probably going to use them, right?
Yep, that's true. That's right. That's right.
So like last thing for me then, do you think Lamar, I hate two-part questions, but this is going to be a two-part question. A, how does Lamar change the way the NFL evaluates quarterbacks? And B, what do you think everyone missed on him when he went 32nd overall in 2018?
Well, it's funny. When I did the quarterbacks that year, I kept on bringing him up with the other 4 quarterbacks. And I kept on saying, I don't know why Lamar Jackson is not included in this list. I said, I must have asked this question 50 times on radio. Why isn't Lamar Jackson included on this list? You know, and I think that sometimes people get stereotyped, and you get stereotyped, and he got stereotyped just being to the athletic quarterback, not just a pure quarterback. And that was where it was. A lot of people right now are wishing they had done what Ozzie did and traded back into that first round to that 32nd spot and taking that guy, because he saw something in him that a lot of those other people didn't see. He didn't just see an athletic quarterback, which he is, but he saw a guy that you could build an offense around, which they have. So, you know, that was good foresight on the part of the Ravens organization.
No question. And it's been incredible to watch. I mean, I'd assume it's even probably like for all of us that hadn't coached, it's fun to watch. I'd imagine for a football coach, it's got to be, you know, kid in a candy store every week watching it happen.
And you want to know what? You only have 1 week to see what you really want to see. A really strong defense, okay, that's got all sorts of momentum playing against a really strong offense that no one could stop.
Yep.
As they play the 49ers this week.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Hey, Charlie, always appreciate talking to you, all right? We'll have you on again soon.
All right, take care.
All right, Charlie is always great. I neglected to mention this. Charlie and I actually worked together on NBC Boston a couple of years ago. Always appreciate his insight. One of the best when it comes to talking offense, talking quarterbacks, covered all of that there. We're going to jump right into your mail now. You guys know how this works. Every week, I put the call out. You guys are free to get to me whenever you want to. And there are two ways that you can get to me. One is via email. That's BreerMailbag@gmail.com. The other way is to call and leave us a voicemail, which we sort of prefer that because I like the sound of hearing you guys' voice. And you guys get to hear your voices on here. You can do that by leaving us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. Again, you can email at BreerMailbag@gmail.com or call at 201-596-4346. And so to kick the mailbag off, we're going to bring in our executive producer, Shelby Royston. Shelby, question number one.
From Nick, what should the Steelers do about their quarterback situation and having no veteran wide receivers on the roster?
Well, remember now, they had the contract that they struck with Ben Roethlisberger, which if I remember right, is through 2021. Ben gave you his word that he would play through 2021. And so that gives you the flexibility to move forward at the quarterback position with patience. Everything I've heard is that Ben will be fine and ready to go in 2020. And if he's good to go in 2020, you've still got a quarterback that I believe you can win with in Ben Roethlisberger. May not be what he was before, but you can still win with Ben Roethlisberger. So you have some flexibility there to wait if you don't want to sell out for a quarterback in 2020. If he's going to play the next 2 years and he's physically capable of playing at a passable level for the next 2 years, that gives you three draft classes to look at finding your next quarterback: 2020, 2021, 2022. What we know now is Mason Rudolph is not that guy. It seems unlikely that Duck Hodges would be that guy. We also know that because of the Minkah Fitzpatrick trade, they do not have a first-round pick in 2020. So maybe they can trade back into the first round. If Tua Tagovailoa's medicals don't come back the way that you might expect, they could look at that. They could maybe look at a guy who go late first round or somewhere on Friday of the draft. If Jacob Eason comes out, he could be a guy who you could develop behind Roethlisberger. Jake Fromm, another guy who could slide through a little bit. Jordan Love, who's got physical ability, if he declares, he'd be an intriguing one, even though he's had a bad year. Or you could wait for, you know, the next class or the class after that. Wait for your Trevor Lawrence, your Justin Fields class, whatever's in 2022. As for the receiver spot, I wouldn't panic. The Steelers have been as good as anybody at developing young receivers. They have not spent a first-round pick on a receiver since Antonio Holmes, yet they've drafted and developed Antonio Brown, Emmanuel Sanders, Mike Wallace, Juju Smith-Schuster, Martavius Bryant. I look at guys like Deontay Johnson and James Washington on that roster right now and think they'll be fine. Question number two, Shelby.
From Nick, should the Chargers give Easton Stick some reps now that their season is basically over, just to see if he's any good for the future?
I don't know if their season's over, but I wouldn't mind getting a look at him. It'd be sort of like the Ryan Finley situation in Cincinnati, I guess, where the whole reason that the Bengals put Ryan Finley in those games was to see what they had with him, what they had in him. And I think in going back to Andy Dalton this week is an implicit acknowledgement: we don't need to see any more of Ryan Finley. We're good. So that makes them more likely to draft a quarterback in 2020. And so I don't know that they're at the point of, especially because, you know, they'll be getting, I think, Okung back eventually. They'll be getting Derwin James back soon. You know, maybe you can get hot and slip into the playoffs at 9-7. There's some business considerations there with going into the new stadium in 2020 and how they've struggled selling it and all the rest of it. So I think you hang on to this season as long as you can, but I could certainly see where you might want to evaluate what you have in Easton Stick once the season is truly over. Just so you can get a better picture of where you should go at the quarterback position in 2020 and beyond. Shelby, question number three.
From Josh, coming off their bye week, can you touch on the job Mike Vrabel is doing in Tennessee this season, given the personnel there, injuries, and the bold and perhaps unpopular QB move?
I love the way that they have an identity. And this really goes back, I think this goes back beyond Mike a little bit. Like, this goes back to John Robinson getting the general manager job there in 2016. And the job that they've sort of done building an identity, and you've seen it in the way that they've spent their first round picks and drafting guys like, and Taylor Lewan was already there, but taking Jack Conklin high, even though injuries have sort of gotten in the way of that one, drafting Jeffrey Simmons, drafting Derrick Henry. There's a real identity to what they want to be. They want to be tough and physical, and they want to build through the lines of scrimmage. And I think you see that coming together now, where they're tougher than the other team on a pretty consistent basis. It's gotten them to 6-5. Yes, the quarterback situation, I think, sort of gets in the way a little bit. But Ryan Tannehill has played really well. And so I think you ride the Ryan Tannehill thing until the end of the year. You see where that takes you. You make a decision going forward. I would not rule out somebody like Phillip Rivers maybe being a stopgap there. In 2020, maybe Ryan Tannehill is that guy. The quarterback situation is a little complicated, but I love the way that they've built with an identity there. Shelby, question number four.
We have a voicemail.
Hey, Albert. Seems like the Redskins are in a tough spot with the Haskins thing. Obviously, he's looked bad this year. But when they have their top pick next year, would you go QB again and bet on the fact that he's just not going to ever be a great quarterback? Or do you scrap that and go with a top QB? And, you know, just kind of throw Haskins away.
So he didn't give us a name, I don't think. Leave your name so I can address you by name. I would say that we don't know the answer to that right now. Bottom line is, until we know who the head coach is going to be in 2020, until we know whether or not they're going to have a true general manager in there in 2020, it's really, really hard to project what they're going to do at the quarterback position. I think it's premature to be out on Haskins. That said, I also understand how circumstances can affect things. And the Cardinals, to me, are the best example of it, in that they not only drafted Josh Rosen 10th overall, they traded up to get Josh Rosen in 2018. They hired Steve Wilks. There you go. You've got your coach and your quarterback you're going to build around. Well, you know, things went haywire on that staff a little bit. The Cardinals did not trust Steve Wilks to hire guys to replace some of the mistakes that he'd made on that staff. And so they're out on Steve Wilks. They, you know, okay, like, what are we going to do now? We want to bring in an offensive innovator. They bring in Cliff Kingsbury. Cliff Kingsbury sees this kid who's coming out of Oklahoma, who's a fit for what he wants to do and who he has a personal relationship dating back to when the kid was in high school. And now Kyler Murray is the quarterback and Josh Rosen is out. We cannot rule out something like that happening in Washington. Like, whoever they're going to hire, whether it's somebody like Matt Rhule from the college game, I don't think that they'll I think it'd be hard to convince a Matt Rhule or Lincoln Riley to go there, but maybe it's somebody like that. If it's somebody from the pros, whoever it is, is going to have some say on what happens at the quarterback position. So I still think that Dwayne Haskins has potential. He's a smart kid. He needs to grow up, but there's real potential there with Dwayne Haskins if you stick with him. That said, if you bring in a new coach, you have to be all in on that new coach. And if that new coach says, you know what, Tua Tagovailoa is healthy and he's a perfect fit for me, Justin Herbert, he fits exactly what I want to do, then you have to listen to that coach. And so, like, I just think that Dwayne Haskins' future right now is complicated by his circumstances in a similar way to how Josh Rosen's future was complicated by his circumstances a year ago. Shelby, question number five.
From Dave, assuming the 49ers, Saints, and Packers all make the playoffs in the NFC side, who, in your opinion, is the most dangerous team remaining? Seahawks, Cowboys, or Vikings?
So I want to say like Seahawks because of the year Russell Wilson's having, but I'm going to go with the Vikings. I think the playoffs are about having answers, right? Because in the playoffs, you're going to play teams that are good enough to take away what you're good at. And most cases, you're going to play against a team somewhere along the line that's going to take you out of your comfort zone. How many answers do you have? To me, I think the Cowboys could get there. The question is whether or not they're going to win their division, and the question is whether or not they're going to be good enough on the details. So I think the Cowboys, like on paper, would be the team that would have the most answers. I think the Seahawks are getting there, but I'm not sure they're well-rounded enough. When I look at the Vikings, I see a team that roster doesn't have very many holes. And so when you take away one thing that they are good at, they're going to have more answers. They're going to have more answers. Like, you take away Dalvin Cook right now, while Kirk Cousins and Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs, they can beat you. You take advantage. You want to throw the ball on them to try to take advantage of their corner situation. Well, they've got pass rushers that can get to the quarterback, and they've got a scheme that pressures. I just think that the playoffs are so much about answers, and to me, the Vikings probably at this point have more answers in those sorts of spots than the Cowboys or the Seahawks would. But it's close. Shelby, question number 6.
Got another email here, or voicemail.
Hey, Albert. Linda here from Southern California. As a multi-generational dysfunctional Raider fan, I'm having a hard time believing all the hype about how they're turning the franchise around and they're playoff bound. What do you think? Give me a level-headed analysis. Love your podcast. Love all you do. Take care.
Well, thank you, Linda. I appreciate it. I look at their schedule and I see winnable games left. The Chiefs is a tough one going to Kansas City. Arrowhead's always a tough place to win. But from there, Titans, Jaguars, Chargers, Broncos. Looking at that and saying 3-1, 3-2 is when you include the Chiefs game this week. I think that's on the table. That gets you to 9-7. I think you're on the edge of the playoffs there. So to me, they're a borderline playoff team right now. And I think you have to look at it this way, right? Try to think about like the way you were in college. I want everybody to do this. Try to think about the way you were in college. You were probably pretty unpredictable, right? Like, you may have been unreliable day to day. You know, one day you're doing one thing, the next day you're doing the next thing. It's probably not the part of your life when you're most consistent. The Raiders right now are relying on a lot of young players in key spots. They're relying on that rookie class. And I think they've got a lot of the right types of kids. But it's hard to be consistent for that period of time at that age. They've got so many young people in key positions right now that I think that they are susceptible to lapses like we saw last week against the Jets. And so I think that what we saw against the Jets was sort of the price you pay for being young. I hope I'm doing a decent job of explaining this. It's sort of the price you pay for being that young and being that reliant on young players as the Raiders are. I think it'll pay off for them too. Like, I think down the line, because you relied on them, because you got them this experience, you're going to be better for it. But in the here and now, I think it does make you more susceptible to these sorts of hiccups. So Linda, do not lose faith in your Oakland Raiders, your soon-to-be Las Vegas Raiders. I still think that group is going places. I think Mike Mayock proved that he can be a pretty damn functional general manager. And John Gruden has shown over the last 2 years that for everything else that's gone on there, he can still coach. I think they're in a good spot going forward, and they've got a great foundation with their young players right now. Shelby? That's it for this week. All right. Appreciate you guys coming out. We always want your feedback. However we can make your podcast better, this podcast better for you, that's what I want to do. So there are different ways that you can get to me. You can get to me through my social media channels, on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. You can also rate and review this podcast on iTunes. That'll help us with our algorithm and everything else. And this podcast now is a part of our larger podcast network. So you get the Monday Morning Podcast, you get Jenny and Connor's podcast, you get the Deep Dive Podcast, you get the Gambling Podcast. All of that is on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. And if you want your daily news in bite-sized form, in a five-minute form that you can just pop it on and get your news for the day on your ride home, well, you can do that with the MMQB news feed. So those are two different podcast feeds, the MMQB NFL podcast feed, the MMQB news feed. You can get both of those on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Appreciate you guys coming out. Happy Thanksgiving. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.